I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Members of Congress had their first chance this morning to question outgoing acting IRS Commissioner Stephen Miller about what he and other IRS leadership knew when about the agency's scrutiny of conservative political action groups. Miller apologized and called the scrutiny, which took place over an 18-month period starting in 2010 and only came to light late last week, a, quote, foolish mistake by people trying too hard to reduce their workload. These requests came after an explosion of applications for tax-exempt status by political groups in the wake of the Citizens United Supreme Court campaign finance ruling. Today, Republican House Ways and Means Committee member Kevin Brady of Texas called it politically motivated targeting, asking, is this still America? And Republican Dave Reichardt of Washington State pressed Miller about why he couldn't provide a name for who was responsible.
Who did you ask?
I asked the senior technical advisor.
And what's the senior technical advisor's name?
Nancy Marks.
And what did Nancy tell you? Who's responsible?
I don't remember, to be honest with you.
You don't remember again?
Well, Bloomberg News Congress editor Jody Schneider is with us from Washington. Jody, what jumped out at you this morning?
Well, I think we had an interesting situation here of somebody who is obviously trying to present the best case possible about what the agency did while acknowledging that a lot of mistakes were made. There's not a big smoking gun here, and it's about bureaucratic decisions made about how to sort applications for tax-exempt status. Normally not really sexy stuff, but because of the political content of it, it becomes, this is what's at the heart of the scandal, and you have lawmakers, particularly Republicans, trying to make a lot of this, and there's not anything really, there's no smoking gun there so far.
Well, what did Miller say about this idea of grouping cases?
Well, he said that they weren't targeting them, that they did not go after these groups because of the kinds of groups they were, because of the views they espoused. Instead, they were trying to figure out a sorting mechanism, essentially, for how to determine whether groups needed, whether groups should be given tax-exempt status. And did say there were errors made, but really stood by the fact that they were not targeted and that no one above this rank, that this did not, there was not given some instructions from Treasury or from the White House to do something in a particular way. That was the story that he was giving in his testimony.
Well, he also told the committee that progressive political groups were also scrutinized, but former Vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan had a pretty good response to that. I mean, were there buzzwords? Was he asked if there were buzzwords that would link a group with progressive politics the way there were buzzwords that would link them with conservative?
Right, and there was not a good answer to that.
Yeah.
We know that the conservative groups, and this has been the allegations, and this is what caused all the uproar, the words Tea Party and Patriot were names that were used to sort these groups out to give them additional scrutiny.
Look, Democrats on the committee today expressed outrage as well at the idea that the IRS would be targeting anyone for political purposes. But we're wondering, did anyone ask the question that New York Times columnist Floyd Norris raised in his column today, which is that, you know, the tax law that's under question is being widely flouted by political groups determined to hide their donors. Norris goes on to say, you know, everyone knows that many but not all of these groups were formed for the purpose of influencing elections and trying to hide as social welfare groups.
That's right, and that's the box Democrats are in. On the one hand, they, you know, obviously have to express and have been expressing their frustration with the agency and their outrage and concern about how this was done. Some of them have begun to say, though, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, that we need a good process for this, and we do need to scrutinize whether groups should have tax exempt status, which allows them to keep their donor secret. But that's a bit of a box for the Democrats this week, and I'm not sure we're going to hear a lot of those kinds of, you know, the issue brought up about the tax-exempt status beyond the way that it was handled by the IRS. I don't think we're going to hear much of that today.
Mm-hmm. Bloomberg News Congress editor Jody Schneider from Washington. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, after last month's devastating garment factory collapse and fire in Bangladesh, are you taking a second look at the labels in your clothing? If you find a made-in-Bangladesh label, is it chilling? Workers there made as little as $38 a month. They were made to work even after the factory was declared dangerous. Then there was the collapse and fire, more than 1,100 killed. Since the collapse, a number of mostly European retailers signed onto a new safety pledge that will require clothing makers to pay for factory upgrades, hold them legally accountable for accidents. It would also create a new governance board to do inspections, rather than the middleman companies that have sprung up and are paid by apparel makers to go and inspect factories. The thinking is that that obviously has not worked. Advocates are calling all this a good first step, but major American retailers like The Gap and Walmart have not signed on. So what should consumers do? Dara O'Rourke is associate professor at the University of California, Berkeley, also co-founder of The Good Guide. It ranks products from clothing to toothpaste on safety and environmental and ethical standards. Dara, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And you are sort of the go-to guy on this, how things are actually made. Have people been calling you asking, you know, what to do after Bangladesh?
Absolutely. I think the scale of this tragedy was just so great, where, as you mentioned, over 1,100 workers died in this one building collapse. And, you know, a week later, another 8 workers died in a fire. Last November, 112 workers died in a fire in Bangladesh. And I think the scale and continuous nature of these tragedies, I think, is having more and more consumers and more people in the U.S. and Europe are kind of stopping and wondering, are there really some kind of hidden costs behind these low, low prices that they've been benefiting from in the store? So I think we're getting more and more people who are asking the simple question of where did my T-shirt come from, or where did my jeans, or where did my cell phone come from, and how was it made, and under what conditions, and really, you know, can I feel good buying this product?
But once you decide to look at your label, then what? The question is, do you stop buying things that say made in Bangladesh? Disney has already announced they'll end clothing production there in Bangladesh. But what does that do to the Bangladeshi workers who already are hardly making anything if factories pull out?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I think that the certainly the advocacy community, the labor unions and the labor NGOs and the student movement have not been calling for a boycott of Bangladesh, have not been calling for companies to cut and run, if you will, but rather for them to commit to investing and actually improving conditions. You know, Bangladesh has the lowest wages in the world for apparel, $38 per month, and the major U.S. brands and retailers have been benefiting, have been profiting off of those low wages and off of very low regulatory standards and very poor conditions, have basically been subsidizing profits for U.S. brands and retailers for the last 10 years. And so I think the request from the advocacy community is for these brands to actually commit to staying and solving these problems and commit to, I think, the first ever multi-stakeholder binding agreement that would obligate the brands to underwrite the costs of both repairing and renovating these buildings, which are way below standards, doing independent safety inspections, reporting those inspections publicly, and terminating factories that don't make upgrades. So this accord is really the first time we've seen the government, the labor groups, the International Labor Organization, and now basically all of the major European retailers and brands have signed on to this critical agreement. The really glaring absence here is of U.S. brands and retailers. The Gap, JCPenney, Children's Place, Walmart are basically not stepping up to take the responsibility to commit to actually solving these tragedies.
Well, let's take a look and see what the concerns might be. For instance, I laid out briefly what the pledge calls for. And one of the things it calls for is this implementation plan and this new governing board, which seems as if it could be wonderful if it could be put together and work, but this idea of having labor, the companies, maybe money coming from governance, what is it? Would it have a seat like at The Hague or something? Where does it exist?
Yeah, no, so it's a very interesting kind of first-of-its-kind initiative that would create a new kind of governing organization that would include the big retailers and brands at the table. They would have seats as well as the big international apparel unions that represent apparel workers around the world, as well as local Bangladeshi NGOs and groups, as well as the Bangladeshi government. So it is really the critical thing about it is that it has a central role for workers. It has a central role for the local organizations to participate in beginning to create binding, enforceable programs. And the U.S. brands, like the Gap, you know, issued a press release saying the legal commitment is something we can't sign on to. The American Apparel and Footwear Association issued a press release that also said, look, legal solutions aren't the answer here. What we want is flexibility. And basically those are all code words for the U.S. brands and retailers don't want to commit to actually paying what it's going to cost and actually spending the next several years committed to bringing up conditions.
Well, but to play devil's advocate, it also sounds kind of unwieldy. Now, you just said Bangladesh government representation. So is this would this be just for Bangladesh? Would there be another one for Cambodia, another one for Vietnam, another one for China? You know, how do you get a governance board in China?
This is starting just on Bangladesh. And the reason it's starting on Bangladesh is Bangladesh really has become, I think, the most glaring example of this race downwards in the global apparel industry, where, you know, the countries you just mentioned, Bangladesh, if you can imagine, is half the wages of Cambodia. In the predominant wage, it's one-fifth of the wages in China. So this is not like China. This is the companies that are fleeing China because wages are too high and costs are too high in China are going to Bangladesh. This is a country where we've had basically failed building inspections, corrupt factory managers, corrupt government officials. This is why Bangladesh needs a special focused initiative to try to turn around this race downwards. And this is something where ultimately, if this works, could be a model for other countries. This is not a silver bullet that's going to solve all of the problems in the apparel industry, and not even all of the problems in the apparel industry in Bangladesh. But this is kind of the first best step forward in Bangladesh in the last 5 years to begin to turn around these problems. It actually really is critical that multiple different stakeholders are at the table. Again, I think it is a smokescreen for industry to say, this is too complicated, it's too unwieldy, it's not flexible enough, we want to just go on our own and solve the problems. That's what Gap said, that's what Walmart said this week. Them going it alone, them hiring their own private consulting firms to audit these factories and then keeping that information confidential has proven not to work over the last 10 years. They need to come to this multi-stakeholder initiative and bring their market force to bring up the entire industry, not just the few factories that they are directly contracting with today.
That's Darrow O'Rourke of The Good Guide. We mentioned that Gap and Walmart did not sign this accord on fire and building safety in Bangladesh. Walmart announced Wednesday it will launch its own initiative. The Gap, as we heard, had concerns about liability, and they've proposed that the remedy for noncompliance with an arbitration order in the pact would be that a company would be expelled from the accord. But as the LA Times points out, that would in effect amount to a company being relieved of any obligations. So there's that response to that. We'll have more with Dara O'Rourke. Are you looking at your labels? More in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. We're taking a closer look at how clothing is made in light of the factory collapse in Bangladesh that killed more than 1,100 workers. A number of major European retailers agreed to an accord that would mandate truly independent safety inspections with things like public reporting. And the American companies Abercrombie & Fitch and Calvin Klein signed on, but as we've been saying, The Gap and Walmart notably absent. Dara O'Rourke is associate professor at UC Berkeley and co-founder of the website Good Guide. They rank brands based on social responsibility. He wants more transparency in manufacturing. And Dara, some brands do have this. They have maps on their website showing all their factories. Here's Eileen Fisher. I'm looking at her website. This is a very progressive clothing maker. She lists 17 factories. Here's the Bolo Ligu factory in China. So there it is. It's listed. It's pictured on a map. Very transparent. But as I look at it, I don't actually know anything about that factory. So you say what?
The next step is that they should be disclosing independent audits of those factories. as in the Bangladesh Accord, it will require independent safety inspections with public reporting.
And again, we're talking about the new accord. We're not talking about the old independent inspections, which turned out to be third-party companies that were paid by clothing makers and so might have been indebted to them. In the new accord, this would be a truly independent inspection. And you say there's something called transshipping that blurs the lines even more. What's that?
Right. In the apparel industry, the history of the industry has been about quotas. The U.S. gives each country in the world a set amount of product they can import to the U.S. So the industry started to do what's called transshipping, where, you know, sew it in China, but if China's met its quota, they'll ship it to another country and then put the label on there saying it came from there. And so that added another layer of complexity. So some of the things we see that are sewn that say made in Italy may not actually be made in Italy, but they're transshipped. The label is literally sewn on in Italy. This is one of the challenges, again, where greater transparency, greater accountability over these supply chains is really critical so that consumers can know really where these products are coming from and what conditions they're being made under.
Yeah, so for instance, we see on Patagonia's website, this is another company that claims to be socially responsible. They show all their supplier locations, and they've got a sewing factory in Bangladesh, but a textile mill in Japan, another factory in El Salvador, a shoe factory in Indonesia. So it's all over the world. And Patagonia is not cheap. That it brings us back round to that. If these companies that are signing on to the accord pass those costs of fixing up factories or paying for private governance boards, it's no longer an $8 T-shirt. It's a $55, Patagonia tank top.
Well, no. First of all, we're talking probably to improve the buildings in Bangladesh. You're talking maybe 20 cents more per garment. So this isn't doubling the price of these garments. And again, this is not the cheapest garments in the world. This is Patagonia is there, Levi's is there, Nike is there, Benetton, Zara, H&M, The Gap. These are companies with very healthy profit margins. And the reason they're in Bangladesh is because the margins are so great. Every brand I talked to 2 weeks ago after the catastrophe said, if we're not in Bangladesh, our competitors are beating us on margin. We're there because it's so profitable. There is margin. There is money in this system to pay for these things. And it really isn't about a question, will consumers pay double? It is, will these brands and retailers pay a fair wage and pay the real costs of production and take a little bit of their profit away? And quite frankly, will U.S. consumers demand that they do it?
How do we do that?
There's a critical role for consumers right now. I would say you should be tweeting a question to your favorite brand. Hey, at Gap, why won't you sign the Bangladesh Accord? Hey, at JCPenney's, hey, at Children's Place. You should be asking publicly, what are they doing to improve conditions in Bangladesh? Why are they not committing to this binding enforceable agreement to improve conditions? We need to move from being passive shoppers to active citizen consumers.
Your life's work has been looking at labels, looking at lists of ingredients. Did you look through your clothing, or I don't know if you have children, through your family's clothing?
Yes, I did. And we found a pair of pajamas that was given to us as a gift that were made in Bangladesh. And, this is something that immediately brought this home for me. Even though I study it, it's still very difficult for consumers to know what they're putting in on around their own family.
We have a colleague who also saw a maid in Bangladesh on a child's clothing, and she started thinking about, whose hands passed over this garment for my child? Are they now gone? I mean, it's kind of, was it, I don't know if you had that same kind of connection.
No, absolutely. I mean, my wife found this pajamas for my daughter that was sewn in Bangladesh, branded Children's Place, which was one of the brands where their product was found in Rana Plaza, the building that collapsed. It immediately, made my stomach sick, and I had the same kind of visceral feeling like, oh my God, who is it that's behind these garments that we wear every day? And, what was the real cost of these garments in human suffering and environmental impact and et cetera, et cetera? And that's something where I think we have a responsibility as U.S. consumers. We have a connection to these factories in Bangladesh, in Cambodia, in China, in El Salvador, and that we need to really take responsibility and play a positive role in this. I'm wearing a pair of Patagonia jeans right now, And I also, you know, sent a message to Patagonia this week asking them about signing this accord. So I think it really is now incumbent upon us to move from being passive consumers to active citizens and to having our voices heard and to speaking up when these tragedies occur.
Dara O'Rourke, associate professor at the University of California, Berkeley, also co-founder of The Good Guide. They list ingredients and manufacturing on products from toothpaste to clothing. Dara, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, and as always, we'd love your thoughts. Are you looking more closely at the labels? Would you actually tweet your favorite brand? Let us know, hereandnow.org. Meanwhile, a couple of items in the Here and Now pipeline. Watergate, back in the news, claims that we're living through it again. Really? There's a new computer game you can play to remind you what that was all about. Also, cultural commentator Touré on the importance of Prince to Gen X. And ahead of Memorial Day, we'll ask, will the Jersey Shore be ready? That's all next week. Coming up, Robert Krulwich on the hierarchy in an elevator after the latest news, Here and Now. The rise in cases of the H7N9 bird flu in China seems to have slowed, but researchers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta are still developing a vaccine to fight the virus, which has killed at least 36 people and infected more than 130. And volunteers are now being recruited for clinical trials. Meanwhile, biologists at Northern Arizona University have pinpointed the source of one of the deadliest plagues of all time. Their discovery solves some ancient mysteries about the first pandemic and could also provide answers in the event of a bioterrorism threat. The results were published in the peer-reviewed scientific journal PLOS Pathogens, and reporter Laurel Morales has our report.
First, a brief history lesson. There were three pandemics associated with plague. The most recent began around 1850, and it's still killing people in some places today. The second one, going back in time, began in the 14th century and included an epidemic called the Black Death that wiped out about 20% of Europe's population. The oldest pandemic started in the 6th century, about 1500 years ago, and likely caused the fall of the early Roman Empire. We didn't know much about it until recently when Northern Arizona University biologist Dave Wagner got involved.
Yeah, so I started working on plague because we have it here in Northern Arizona in native ground squirrels.
About 5 years ago, he changed his focus from squirrels to humans. Wagner and some other scientists mapped out what they call the global family tree of plague to show how it spread around the world. At about the same time, some home builders developing a new subdivision in Munich dug up some ancient skeletons. By German law, they have to stop and let archaeologists inspect the remains.
But they found certain burials where it wasn't just a single individual, it was multiple individuals in the same grave. And traditionally, that's thought to be indicative of an infectious disease coming through and killing a large number of people.
The skeletons were about 1,500 years old, so the best way to find DNA was in their teeth. German scientists ground down the teeth, extracted the DNA, then Wagner and his colleagues isolated and studied the DNA.
Now, most of the DNA that's going to come out of that tooth is going to be human DNA. And so we're sort of looking for a needle in the haystack. We're looking for plague DNA inside all that human DNA.
And keep in mind that it's ancient DNA, so it's been degraded and fragmented over time. Biologist Don Birdsell was the one who first confirmed the teeth had the plague bacterium called Yersinia pestis. She couldn't wait to tell Wagner.
Oh, I did. I was extremely excited. It was very late at night, though, so Dave was asleep. But he got the email at 4 a.m. when he wakes up.
They then repeated the process several times in different labs to ensure the results were the same. The Arizona and German scientists confirmed the plague bacterium caused the first pandemic. Their discovery dispels many other theories. The team then took their study a step further, using molecular technology to develop a DNA fingerprint. This enabled them to locate the likely source of the first pandemic to China, where they found a similar strain. David Engelthaler is an epidemiologist who works at TGen.
Plague, perhaps like maybe no other disease, has changed the course of human history multiple times. So what these researchers found really advanced our understanding of the history of plague. It's also helped explain the human history as well. So it's fairly significant.
Now, you may be wondering why we don't see major pandemics today. two reasons. Our hygiene has improved and we've cleaned up our cities. And Dave Wagner says antibiotics pretty much take care of the first sign of plague.
But in places where those things aren't as well established, for example, Madagascar and other places in Africa, there are still hundreds, if not thousands, of cases, human cases of plague every year.
Plague may not be an infectious disease that many people are concerned about today, but the Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, has been very interested in these results. Wagner says if there was a bioterrorism event, the agency would want to detect it quickly and develop a DNA fingerprint to determine the source.
And so we see this as the ultimate validation of those approaches that we've developed for DHS, because if you can do this on a strain from 500 AD, then you should be able to do it on contemporary material that might be used in a bioterrorism event.
Wagner and his team's next step is to piece together the genome to try to learn what made the strain so deadly.
That's Laurel Morales in Flagstaff, Arizona. Her story comes to us from Fronteras, the Changing America Desk. That's a public radio collaboration in the Southwest that focuses on the border and changing demographics. Take a break. Be back in 30 seconds, here and now. The discovery of three missing women in Cleveland generated joyous news coverage and fixed the spotlight on the number of children still missing. Our next guests hope that spotlight widens to include the disproportionately large number of missing African Americans. Blacks make up around 12% of the population, but according to the nonprofit Black and Missing Foundation, they make up about a third of all missing people in the U.S., and we don't hear about them because of TV's fixation with blondes. Derricka Wilson is a former police officer and co-founder of the Black and Missing Foundation. Derricka, you say there's actually a name for what some people think is this syndrome?
Yes, that's the missing white women syndrome, and it just states that, you know, the media really focuses on those young, pretty white females that are missing, blonde hair, blue eyes. And, you know, with our community, they really didn't realize that this was a huge problem, because when we turn our televisions on, you know, we do not see anyone that looks like us. So we always say less is more. Less of one particular race and more of everyone who's missing, it greater the chances of a reunion.
And of course, it's not the fault, we should say, of these white women who've been abducted, often murdered, but it doesn't even communicate to the African-American community that there's this huge problem in their community. Let's bring in someone who knows a thing or two about this. Rita Mims is the aunt of Evelyn Shelton, who's been missing since May of 2011. Rita joins us from Spartanburg, South Carolina. Rita, you know, we are sorry this has still got to weigh so heavily on you.
It's been a very, very hard time for our family, but, you know, you just have to hold on to your faith.
Well, but you also have to let people know, and let's let people know about Evelyn. Now, she was older. She was 42 when she went missing in May of 2011. Yep. Last seen at a male friend's house. The trail disappears. What did you do?
Right away, we just came together as a family. We got the local community and the churches involved, and we did a distribution of flyers going door to door, not, you know, questioning anyone, just asking them to keep their eyes and ears open and don't turn, you know, a blind eye to whatever they felt might be significant.
And Derricka, a couple of questions for you, because this sounds heartbreaking. Evelyn Shelton had gone to nursing school, seemed to have a promising future, but the police have nothing to work with. All the leads have dried up. They have no evidence of a crime. So what would you want to see happen in this case?
You know, a couple of months after Evelyn went missing, I was contacted by her brother, Timothy Shelton, and the weekend of July the 2nd, 2011, my organization went down to Spartanburg, South Carolina, and we actually did a search for Evelyn. And the police didn't want to be involved. They state that they didn't have enough manpower to even come out there. So we walked through the woods. We walked through residential areas. And that day, we found Evelyn's wallet in a sewage drain. That was a break in the case.
Well, and also what you are saying is that police could have and should have found that.
Absolutely. According to law enforcement, they had actually searched that area.
I have to recognize Derricka for just forming that search and just showing us how to do it.
Well, and Derica,
so
you're
I just praise God for her.
Well, and Derica, you're a former police officer. So what are your thoughts about, obviously you feel the media isn't covering the stories in the way that it should of missing African-Americans. And it sounds as if you don't think the police is doing the job either.
Absolutely. What I can say is that when I spent 6 months in the police academy, only 2 hours was dedicated to missing person cases. You know, it's important to let it be known that missing persons is not considered a crime, so there's no sense of urgency with it. But we need to change the laws. These people are just vanishing without a trace. We rely heavily on the community because if you see something, say something. And that's one of the things that we put on our website, an anonymous tip line, so people can report information and not feel that they have to compromise their identity.
Well, you not only have the tip line, which you know law enforcement also has, but you've created your own media. You have a TV outlet for missing cases. It's called Find Our Missing. It's on the cable channel TV One. It just is astonishing that you would be able to fill up a cable channel with missing people, but then when we hear that African Americans make up a third of the people missing in the U.S., you have a lot of stories to tell.
Yes. I mean, we don't want these cases to go cold. I mean, the Cleveland, Ohio case proved that. Their families never gave up hope, and that's what we want to instill in the families that we're working with.
Well, Derica, why do you think it is that missing African Americans are not covered as much by the media? I mean, we're tiptoeing around something here.
Well, you know, when it comes to children under the age of 18 who are minorities, they are classified as runaways. So our runaways are not getting an Amber Alert. When it comes to missing adults, a lot of times people like to associate them with some sort of criminal activity, whether it's gangs, whether it's prostitution. But I can honestly say to you that we have knocked on doors of many media outlets, and we've been told by decision makers that these stories of our missing minorities, it's just not sensational enough. So these are typically, you know, middle-class white men who are actually making the decision based on what they think society wants to hear and see. So we really need more diversity in the newsroom.
And Rita Mims, again, aunt of Evelyn Shelton, who's been missing since May of 2011. It might have been reminding you that more attention is paid to missing women who are not of color when we heard the Cleveland story. But did it also give you hope that behind some door? Yeah.
Immediately, as soon as I saw it, my gut started to bubble up. The gentleman that helped them escape
in Cleveland, yeah,
he's not the typical person that you would expect to go bust down a door and free someone. I pray to God that that is a scenario for her, because we want her home.
Well, again, we'll have pictures at our website. And Derica, I understand you're a former police officer, but you don't personally, you've never personally lost someone. So what's the impetus behind you founding this group, the Black and Missing Foundation?
The inspiration behind the organization was a young lady who went missing from Spartanburg, South Carolina, my hometown. Her name was Tamika Houston, and it was very painful watching the struggles of her family try to garner local and national news. And months later, Natalie Holloway disappeared, and her story was dominating local and national news, and it still is. Now, I just want to be frank. You know, we're not trying to dishonor any community. We just want an even playing field, and our organization focuses on all missing persons of color. So it doesn't matter if you're Black, you're Asian, you're Hispanic, you're all important. Mm.
Well, and of course, Natalie Holloway, who disappeared in Aruba, and it was quite a sensational story. Derica Wilson, co-founder of the nonprofit Black and Missing Foundation. Also, Rita Mims, aunt of Evelyn Shelton, who's been missing since May of 2011. Thank you both, and Rita, best of luck to you.
Thank you so much for having
us. Thank you.
Okay, we'll take a break. When we come back in a couple of minutes, a coda to that talk about a truck that inspired a country song. That and more in 1 minute here and now. Have you ever found yourself in the elevator? Going floor to floor. More and more people joining you. There's a little crowd in here. Could you move over? Do you mind moving over? Do you ever wonder why some stand in the back, some in the middle, some chat?
Candy, I love your earrings.
Thank you.
I think
they're
Some are clearly uncomfortable.
It's kind of cozy, don't you think?
Let's ask Robert Krolwich of WNYC's Radiolab. He's going to be joining us occasionally to talk about his blog, Krolwich Wonders. I think he's in here somewhere. Robert?
Surprised you can see me looming so much behind you. I would think you would have to have twisted, I guess you just did. You twisted your neck all the way around to find me here.
Because you're one of the tall, powerful men.
I am a tall, powerful man. Yes, exactly. So, and you know that because look where I am. I'm in the back.
You are
tall, powerful land.
You are in the back of our virtual elevator because...
Yes.
Because why? Who determined that the back of the elevator is tall, powerful man area?
Well, we're talking science here, actually. There was a woman, there still is a woman, named Rebecca Roussey, who's getting her PhD at the University of Unpronounceable. It's somewhere in Finland. It's spelled J-Y-V-A-S-K-Y-L-A, which I will call Jysk.
Everyone knows
anyway,
that.
Anyway, she goes there. Before she went to the University of Jyväskylä, she was in Adelaide, Australia, and she decided that she would do a close look at elevator positioning. And she found a pattern. And one of them is that the older, more, as she called them, powerful men, this is more senior men, would be in the back, younger men in the middle, and all women in the front of any age. And the men in the back would be roaming with their eyes, that is, cruising wildly, looking in at everybody. The men in the middle, the same. And the women, almost universally downcast and trying not to be interested in anything, unless the women were in the elevator by themselves, in which case they would exchange glances if there were no guys there.
Well, what do we make of this?
She didn't even know what to make of it. She proposed any number of things. Is it something to do with height? No. I mean, if you're worried about being in front of somebody that might be rude to be in every, you know,
right,
to be blocking them, then you would go to the back if you were tall. But it wasn't about tallness. She said maybe it's curiosity. People in the back can see everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So the curious people go to the back and the incurious or the fearful go to the front. She says, but, you know, does that mean that all women in Adelaide are fearful? She wasn't comfortable with that idea.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's something practical. Maybe if you get into an elevator and you're getting off on the second floor, you stand towards the front. If you're getting off on the 11th floor, you go to the back because you know you're not going to leave right away and you want other people to have the freedom to come and go. From what I talked to her on the telephone, she said it didn't seem to have anything to do with your destination. So maybe it's first in. Maybe it's just like if you go in, you go to the back, and maybe like senior men just waltz into the elevator.
First?
Yeah, so there's a whole smorgasbord of possibilities without any real answer that she knows. It's one of those puzzles that you have to sort of think about.
She asked you to ask your followers, your people?
Those are my readers, my peeps.
what were some of the suggestions?
A lot of folks said, this is a politeness thing, the older men come from a generation which they're just trained to be a little bit more polite. They said, but that didn't explain why the older women didn't go to the back, because they presumably would be just as polite as the older men.
Well, we, of course, also invite listeners to suggest, why do you think it is that older, more powerful men go to the back of an elevator? The younger men go to the middle. And by the way, the other thing she observed is that if there's a mirror in the elevator at all...
If there's a mirror, the guys will use the mirror to check out the women and to check out themselves. Like, the guys are full of, look at me, look at her, look at. And the women are not looking unless they're alone, unless they're with other women.
Robert Krolwich, to read his blog, Krolwich Wonders, go to hereandnow.org as well. And weigh in. Robert, thank you for posing a question that you don't have an answer to.
Yeah, well, a lot of mine have no answer. That's how science works, though, a lot of the time. You ask, and then you wait 100 years.
Okay. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, longtime listeners know Paul Monty. He's been on Here and Now several times talking about his son Jared, who was killed in Afghanistan in 2006 while trying to save another badly wounded soldier. When Paul visited Jared's grave at the Massachusetts National Cemetery, he was surprised that rules prohibited flags on the graves. He got that changed, then started Operation Flags for Vets. Just before Memorial Day 2011, hundreds of volunteers responded to his call and came to plant flags near 56,000 graves. Here Now's Alex Ashlock spoke to Paul that day.
I think I have this right. Do you still drive Jared's truck?
Yes, I do.
There it is. It's him. It's got his DNA all over it. I love driving it because it reminds me of him, though I don't need the truck to remind me of him. I think about him every hour of every day. I'm happy driving it. He's with me. But he's with me all the time anyway.
Well, you may have heard in a lovely story on All Things Considered that listener Connie Harrington heard that conversation and co-wrote this song, which is now number one on Billboard's country chart.
89 cents in the ashtray, half-empty bottle of Gatorade rolling in the floorboard.
It's been quite a time for Paul Monty. He's on the line. Alex Ashlock is here in the studio. And Paul, we just wanted to congratulate you on the recognition of you and your son and ask, how are you doing with this?
The first thing I want to say, Robin, is it's really not about me and my son.
Yeah.
It's about all those Gold Star families out there that are holding on to something, whether they drive their child's truck or their car, or they hold on to a pair of boots or a CD or a shirt or something that they wore. It's all about them.
Yeah.
The response has been overwhelming. It's been, thank you for doing this. It's helped me heal. I drive my son's vehicle too, and so on, and it's really overwhelming.
Well, I tell you what, I have a thought about how people might act on their feelings. What do you do on Memorial Day, Paul?
On Memorial Day. Well, actually, on the Saturday before Memorial Day is when we're going to be planting the flags in Bourne. This year it's 57,000 flags. They've added 1,000 graves since last year.
Yeah. Will you be driving the truck down there?
Oh, absolutely.
Paul, I'll see you down there.
Always a pleasure to see you, Alex. And it's a pleasure to see you come down and help to honor the veterans that have kept this country free.
If you saw this tear rolling down on my face, hey, man, I'm trying to be tough. And Mama asked me this morning if I'd been by your grave. But that flag and stone ain't where I feel.
I can't listen to that song all the way through. I mean, I just tear up after the first, you know, I drive your truck, that's about it. You know? That's the response I get from everybody. And I mean, when I say everybody, you know, it's not just emotional women. It's guys that will email me and tell me, I'm sorry, Paul, I tried to listen to the song, but I teared up halfway through it. And if I want to put it in my terms, here's Jared saying, hey, Dad, this song will really help a lot of the other families out there.
Well, thanks so much for the work you do. Alex will see you Saturday. We'll see you sometime soon. And again, congratulations on the recognition and best to you.
Well, thank you very much.
I drive your truck.
Paul Monty, his son Jared killed in Afghanistan. Here now is Alex Ashlock. You always have an eye for the good story. Congratulations to you as well.
Thank you, Robin.
Sometime I drive your truck.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend. And join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.